dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The subjects of religion, sex, and politics have long been considered too controversial for polite conversation, but the weather was always a safe area. Not anymore. The weather is now one of the most urgent political issues we face, or in the case of the U.S. establishment, avoid facing. Tonight, the Weather Report from Hell. We'll begin with the latest on global climate change. Mike McCormick speaks with the author of a new book.
We are talking today with Mark Linus. He is author of High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. Mark, let's begin with, can you tell us what the motivation was for writing High Tide?
Well, you know what? I used to be a proper environmental activist. I used to do the Julia Butterfly stuff and sit up trees and build tunnels to try and stop damaging road projects back in the UK where I'm from. And I'd done this for a couple of years, really, as part of the Earth First movement and so on. And it just began to dawn on me that there was this much bigger scale thing going on. And so we could stop, well, we couldn't actually. We tried to stop individual roads or even airport runways from being built and destroying sort of large swathes of what was left of the British countryside. And yet at the same time, I knew that gradually there was this threat called global warming, which was looming over everything, which would be a million road projects over the countryside in terms of the actual damaging effect it would have. And so it was almost a shift from the local to the global that was happening within the movement. And it was really, that I think that was what raised my awareness that there was this big looming crisis happening. And so I began to find out more about it. And then coincidentally, back in 2000, we had these incredible floods in Britain. And so I just remembered there was this sort of torrential rain. Something I'd never really experienced before. And when I started to look into the background to this and spoke to some of the scientists, they were telling me that there was this trend towards heavy rainfall and it was pretty clearly linked with global warming. So it was almost as if climate change came to me first. And then after that, I started to go off and see different places around the world where it's already happening.
So how did you end up choosing the places that you ended up going to?
Well, it was a process of research and also places that caught my interest most, but I really wanted to show how this was a worldwide issue by visiting different continents and choosing a different kind of case study for each different continent that I visited. But the sort of the central theme is really a trip back in my own past by retracing the steps that my father took when we were living in Peru, and he was part of this geological expedition up into the highest part of the Andes. And so I went up there, of course, armed with a picture of how some of the glaciers looked when he was studying them in 1980. And so there is a sort of a central theme of this book is almost me, let's say, retracing my father's steps. And the before and after pictures are in the beginning of the book, which show really, really incredibly striking images of how the glaciers have disappeared within the space of just 20 years. And, you know, I was stunned when I saw this. I hadn't expected it at all.
Was that true of all the places you visited, that you kind of went in with a certain expectation level and found out it was worse?
Yeah, if anything, because often when, you know, I've also worked as a journalist, and often when you look into a story, you find there's not much actually supporting it. You know, the stories can have a sort of habit of evaporating the deeper you prod around. But it was almost the opposite when I was doing this, that the impacts of climate change that I could find out about from research on the internet or phoning up people and so on were nothing compared to actually what I saw with my own eyes. You know, when I was in north of China, in Inner Mongolia, I'd heard that there were these dust storms and so on, but being in one and actually experiencing how the land's turning so rapidly to desert because they've got these terrible droughts, which are again linked with climate changes, you know, the whole world just turned dark. There was just dust everywhere. You can't breathe. You know, it was really quite an experience. And so that kind of thing adds a bit of drama to the book as well, because, of course, I was writing a travelogue. There's been so many academic, you know, dull books about climatology and so on, and I wanted to do something which would hopefully reach out to a more wider audience, especially at this time, you know, I began to have some sense of people getting more interested in global warming. And it's certainly the case now that it's really beginning to, there is sort of a wave, I think, of hopefully, which is beginning to raise people's awareness in a way which hasn't been the case before. And there has been this kind of conspiracy of silence about climate change, which has been promoted by the highest levels of the government in this country, and also the corporations. So perhaps people are beginning to break through this sort of corporate wall of silence.
So let's talk about some of the different areas that you did view firsthand. And the first place you said was in your home in the UK.
That's right. And so I went and visited different parts of the country which are affected by flooding. And my first destination was York. And all the railways were cut off. I mean, this was the worst incidence of flooding that had happened since records began in the UK, which I think was back in 1766. So there'd been, you know, 300 years of records, and there'd been nothing like this in the past before. And I went down also to the Welsh borders.
What time of year was this at?
This happens in winter. Okay. So it's a strange trend, because you get more dry weather in the summer, and so it's getting hotter in the summer. It's also warmer in the winter, but you get much heavier rainfall in the winter. So it's the weather patterns are changing in all of the different seasons. And the one of the guys I met in this little village on the Welsh borders, who owned a restaurant, and there was mud halfway up his walls. He'd just been flooded out for the third time that year. And he said, you know, look, we don't get a winter anymore. We don't get snow. We don't get ice. What we get is a wet season. It's almost like we've moved to the tropics. And that phrase, Britain's wet season, became the chapter title, because it really stuck with me as sort of summing up what the changes that people are seeing, which are this dramatic.
It actually kind of struck me, because it seemed a lot of what you were describing that was happening there seems to be what we're starting to get here in the Pacific Northwest. We're getting our winters are getting much tamer, but we're getting these rains that come fewer and farther between. But when they do come, it's just this torrential downpour for, like, you know, 12, 24 hours, where you get like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month's worth of water. Mm. And that sounds like what was happening in the book.
Yeah, and obviously what I've been telling you so far is anecdotal stuff, but this is where, I mean, also in the book there is a foundation of science, and if you look into the scientific records of what's happening with the precipitation, as you get a warmer atmosphere, it can hold more water vapor, and therefore for the same precipitation event, there's simply more water able to fall out of the sky, and you get, therefore, heavier rainfall. And so it's a very clear relationship with having a warmer atmosphere of getting these kinds of, as you say, more torrential rain. And the records show that it's happening right across the Northern Hemisphere. So it's a global phenomenon. It's happening in America. It's happening in Russia. It's happening in the mid-latitudes, also in the Southern Hemisphere, in places like South Africa and even Australia. So, yes, something's happening. And the counterbalance of that, of course, is worse drought. And so in places like China, where I visited, all of the rain which is now falling in places like here and in the UK isn't falling in places like China. And so they've had droughts there which were the worst for centuries. And there's places I went where you can sort of walk across lake beds and there's old boats just sitting there, and people told stories about how they used to be fisher people, you know. And they, of course, there's no fish for miles around because there isn't a drop of water in the whole of the place. So that's that kind of thing. And of course, what really strikes you is that the people, I was the first person they'd ever told their stories to. And so this is happening quietly, you know. There isn't a great fanfare, and there isn't, CNN isn't there when their first islanders leave their islands and have to move to higher land because of rising sea levels. It's so we don't really get to hear about it, even though global warming itself is catching people's interest. It affects the poor, and it affects people who are vulnerable in ways which we have very little experience of, and which we can't really help them.
That's another feature of your book that I really enjoy, is the fact that you talk to both scientists, but the real bulk of it is talking to regular people and kind of getting their stories, and people that have, it sounds like you actually seek out the older people because they're the ones with, you know, the
exactly.
Memory.
Older people are best because, of course, they've got a whole lifetime of experience and they can say the weather's changed, because these things have happened quite recently. I mean, in geological time, it's just a blink of an eye that this stuff's all happening in. But in terms of our, you know, our human experience, it's trends over 30 or 40 years, which are the ones that you've got to look out for. And, of course, old people can say, well, when I was a kid, the water didn't come up here. And that kind of thing is really valuable.
Was Alaska the next place you visited after the UK?
Yeah, Alaska I went to in 2001. And, you know, this is a story that probably is more familiar to people in this part of the world, certainly in the Pacific Northwest. People are probably, there's been stuff in the New York Times about this since then as well. And because Alaska not being contiguous with the lower 48, but also being part of America, the stories get out much more widely. And it really is quite striking what you see in terms of how the melting of the permafrost is affecting buildings and roads. You know, you're almost like being seasick when you're driving along the roads, because you're going up and down these undulations, because as the permafrost melts, the ice thaws in the ground and the water runs away, and so the ground actually collapses. And so you can see direct evidence of this. There's places where buildings are tilting over at crazy angles. And it's also affecting wildlife in that part of the world. There's forests which are basically turning into bogland as the permafrost melts, and the animal behaviors are changing quite dramatically. Bears don't know whether to hibernate. Species like ducks, which fly south for the winter, are still there in December. You know, and I spoke to particularly the native people, have a lot of interesting experiences here because they live so close to the land. And there was one village on the coast I went to, and people were saying that they'd chased all over the sea for thousands of miles and caught only one walrus, you know, because the migration patterns of these animals have changed. They disappeared up north to try and keep the colder ice much earlier in the year, because the ice retreats that much earlier. So there's all sorts of ways in which global warming is happening, and it's happening much faster in places like Alaska, which are at the poles, obviously, than it's happening in lower down in latitudinally. So you see an acceleration of global warming, and that's really, it's happening that much more quickly there. There's something like 6 degrees of warming they've experienced in the winter in the last 30 years, which is off the map, really.
When I first started reading about global warming 10 or so years ago, they predicted a lot of this, but you didn't even get the impression back then that it would be kicking in as badly as it is now. You know, you expected that like 50 years from when they're writing that. Is that what you have heard from scientists as well, that this is like way ahead of schedule?
Yeah, I really feel this, and I feel that this year as well. It's almost, you know, when you get very familiar with the subject, you don't actually stay scared, but I stay scared on this because I keep hearing new things. I mean, we had this incredible heat wave in 2003, just last year, in Europe, and you probably heard about it. I'm sure it must have made the news partly, that 20 or 30,000 people died simply because of these incredibly cripplingly high temperatures. And at the time, people weren't sure whether to ascribe it to global warming. You know, you want to be scientific. No one wants to suggest that a single event is to do with climate change and so on. But then when the scientists did look at it and they figured out the statistical possibility of this kind of heat wave happening, it was like a 1 in 100,000 year event. I mean, it was completely off the scale. It was actually statistically impossible. And this kind of heat wave comes into the computer models of what the predictions are, but it comes in 2050, 2060, 2070. And we had it in 2003, you see? And I think it's that kind of thing that really gives us a shock that perhaps global warming is beginning to accelerate, and perhaps the Earth is going to respond much more quickly, because we tend to think of it as a very slow, long-term process. Perhaps it's not. Perhaps things are changing much more rapidly, and perhaps we will lose control of it. I certainly hope not, because if global warming accelerates out of control, then we are in the kind of trouble which we'll see the likely collapse of human civilization. And this is what writing this book is sort of aimed at, raising awareness so that we can still start to mitigate climate change while we still have time.
So after Alaska, where did you go next?
After Alaska, I went to Tuvalu, which will be soon, because these are the islands. This is an island nation in the South Pacific, which is affected by rising sea levels. And it was soon after arriving there, actually, and the land is only about half a meter above sea level, because these are coral atolls and they're very low lying. And soon after arriving there, we were splashing around in water, which was being forced up through the rock by the high tide. And there was first it's puddles, and then there's a lake, and then pretty much half of the town is underwater. You know, and people will say that this is something which didn't used to happen 30 years ago. So, again, you've got very visual evidence of how global warming is affecting rising sea levels and how it's affecting people directly there. And they are planning for the end in this place. I mean, they're 75 people a year are now leaving the islands to live in New Zealand. So they're more or less starting the evacuation of their entire country. And people are asking questions about why their country has to go under when they've done so little to cause the problem. I mean, it's a tiny country. They use hardly any fossil fuels, so they're hardly causing any aspect of the global warming crisis. And yet they're the first ones to suffer. And so they're also thinking perhaps of trying to sue the United States or maybe sue ExxonMobil or to try and get some kind of financial recompense for this. But it doesn't really look like the legal, international legal system will allow that kind of liability. But the moral liability is crystal clear.
Now, they're obviously experiencing this firsthand, and my understanding is that they had done numerous trips in the past when they discovered that the water level was rising. They had gone to the, you know, the Western nations and said, look at what we're experiencing here. What happened when they did that?
Well, yes, the Tuvaluans have been very forward in actually trying to draw attention to their plight. They were always there at the UN International Climate Change conferences. There actually was a group of the, it was called the AOSIS, rather like Oasis, rather like sort of Atlantis, sort of evoking that kind of image. But the AOSIS groups of the small island states were there as a block, and they were arguing most strongly, of course, for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, they always got overruled, and or if they did get some promises, they were empty promises, nothing would ever happen. So I think the Tuvaluans got pretty cheesed off and went back to feed their pigs and gather coconuts and do all the things they were doing. And they've carried on trying to get these kinds of messages into the international media, but they've realized that as small countries, they have very little weight on the political stage. And it's not until countries like the US and like Europe as well throw their weight behind climate change mitigation that we're actually going to get somewhere.
Yeah, I know it's a very proud moment for the US when we haven't signed the Kyoto Accords. But my understanding is, even if we did do that, that's not nearly enough based on what is currently happening to stop that.
You're talking about Kyoto directly?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Kyoto talks about 5% reductions, and that's only amongst industrialized countries. So, and actually, there's all sorts of loopholes, which means they wouldn't even achieve the 5%. So in actual fact, it's pretty much a drop in the ocean. But the way that the people defend Kyoto, and I'm one of them, is that it's a first step, and you have to learn to walk before you can run. And so perhaps that is then the basis on which you can build a more lasting international climate treaty, which would go the distance that you need to go to actually solve global warming. But that's a long way off. And, you know, while we've got countries like Australia and like the US and possibly even Canada and Japan still being obstructionist about dealing with climate change and being in sort of in denial about it, we're not going to get anywhere. And so, again, it comes down to people, to real people, to trying to make global warming an electoral issue and trying to get it on the political agenda.
Were there any plans for the island nations to try and, I don't know, pile on rock and dirt on top of there to build the islands up to withstand this?
Well, that's not really possible because there isn't any. There aren't materials out there. I mean, if they actually build roads on Tuvalu with some of the development money, and all the aggregates for that come from Fiji in a big tanker, you simply can't, on a coral atoll, there simply isn't any material to enable you to raise your land level, and you couldn't really do that and live a normal life either, because one of the problems which is happening there is that people grow their vegetables, this sort of root crop like taro called pulaka, in pits, which grows off the groundwater there. And as you get sea levels rising, you get salt water coming into these pits, and it kills off the plants. And so the whole basis of the sort of subsistence economy that they have, and coconut trees and all this kind of thing, it depends on nature. You can't live completely in an artificial, on an artificial island. It just isn't sustainable for people to do that, and nor is it economically feasible. So they have to move. That's the only option.
When you had the idea for producing this book, did you know that you would be going to all these different places ahead of time? Did you have to like pitch the book and your publisher would pay you for some of these trips?
Well, that was always the idea, but you know what it's like when you get an idea and you figure it out, you know that you're going to go and do it anyway. So I went to Alaska before I'd got a publishing deal even, and I sort of knew in my heart of hearts I was going to go there and do this journey come what may. But then I did get a contract with HarperCollins. It's published by Picador in the US, but it was HarperCollins originally in the UK that bought it. And they gave me an advance, you know, an author's advance, which paid for quite a lot of the trip. So whilst I ended last year in debt, I wasn't nearly as deeply in debt as I would have been otherwise. And also you have the knowledge and you have the guarantee of actually getting the book out there, which is a real privilege, I think, to know that you're going to have a publisher behind you who's going to be doing the promotional work, who's going to be making the book look good, and is going to be getting it out there into the shops. Because, you know, there's so many people who write really great books which are published by niche publishers, and they just don't go anywhere because people don't find out about them, and that's a big shame. So I went with HarperCollins, which is part of the News International. It's the Murdoch empire, so, you know, we're dancing with the devil here. But the point of going with a corporate publisher was to get access to that kind of distribution with what is quite a radical message.
So you're at Tuvalu. Is that at that period in time, did you know you were about halfway through the places you were going to visit?
I had a sort of itinerary, but it evolved because, I mean, as I say, I did these trips over a period of about 3 years. And I went back to my home base in Oxford to do more research and to sort of rest, because if you're doing a global journey like that, and if you go from one place to another, then you just find that it's incredibly difficult to sustain yourself, because you've got to find out where you're going next. There's a lot of work you've got to do, and you just get exhausted. I mean, think of all the the jet lag as much as everything else. So it took a long time to do this, because when I was in the location, I had to really put everything into it and spend a lot of time with people. And really begin to try and see things through their eyes, so that I could really feel the way that the people feel the impacts that they're seeing in front of them.
Yeah, I guess that's where I was going, was thinking about the emotional strain of like going to these different places and continually getting this bad news.
Yeah. You know? Well, and it's an issue that comes up when I'm promoting the book. When I'm doing talks, for example, I sometimes do a little health warning and say, you know, this, what you're about to see is probably the most depressing thing that you ever, you know, there should be some kind of label you could put. But the problem is that it is depressing, and there isn't very many ways you can sweeten the pill, because what we are talking about is a level of loss, not just in human terms, but in terms of the natural world as well, which is very difficult to comprehend. And there's people I work with who also do climate change stuff in Britain, and you kind of find that everybody's had this experience when all of a sudden there's something that triggers them in their minds, and there's something which suddenly makes it go from an intellectual issue in their heads to an emotional issue in their hearts. And one of the people who I quote in the book, who actually came up with the solution to global warming, which we can talk about in a second if you like, a guy called Aubrey Mayer, he said that when he first figured it out, he was basically crying in the corridor for a week. You know, and he's a strong, articulate, you know, guy, very experienced, pretty, you know, incredible intelligence, and yet it just hit him in some way. He was thinking about his daughter's future, in fact, and it was that, not his own future, that really. And I had the same sort of experience when I was at the UN climate conference in The Hague. Ironically enough, I was at a US the American delegation briefing. And they were just coming out with all of this sort of waffle about how America was extremely committed to stopping climate change and so on, whilst behind the closed doors they were busy shooting everything down that they possibly could. And it was somehow, I had that realization that these people were not going to do the job for us. They were going to take us over the edge and further. They were going to destroy the planet, basically. And I wanted to sort of stand up and shout and go, "You sons of bitches, how can you do this?" And That was what hit me, and I left that room almost in tears. And I, you know, it was, and I think that moment is that kind of moment that you have, which keeps driving you on and keeps driving you on. And so I've had that in me. It's almost a religious thing, actually. And I shouldn't say that, because this is a scientific issue, but your commitment comes from that sort of level of willpower and that level of emotional commitment, I think. So that's the intensity of it when you're working with this. And it is very difficult sometimes to get out of bed in the morning. It is also very difficult to stay positive, because the enormity of the problem and the lack of response that you get from everybody that you talk to about it. You know, "Oh, I've got to drive my car." "Oh, well, that's that then." "The planet had better die," you know. It is very difficult to keep thinking that there's a way through this, but what other choice have we got? There's got to be a way through it, and if there is a way through it, we've got to find it.
So what solutions have you encountered in this trip?
Well, there's different levels of this. I mean, there's personal changes we can all make in our own lifestyles, which are things as obvious as driving your car less or giving up your car. I mean, I haven't had a car for years now, but it's easier to do that when you're not living somewhere like, well, Seattle, or even worse, like LA, where you've got incredible sprawl and there's just simply no way to shift quickly to public transportation or even bicycling. But there's that kind of thing. You know, you can switch to green electricity in the UK as well, where you simply just fill in a form and you get renewable power. Which is pretty good. You can change your own light bulbs to more energy efficient. I mean, simply it's a case of reducing your own fossil fuel consumption and therefore your own emissions. But actually, I think that's only the basis of action. We've really got to tackle this at the political level now. It's got to become an issue which people feel they're part of a movement, and they feel they're part of a growing movement which is actually going to go somewhere. And the political solution, which I think is most sane, really, is this one called contraction and convergence, where essentially what happens is that all of the world's countries get together and they agree on a budget for greenhouse gas emissions. And they say, okay, we're going to stay within this limit of global warming, therefore we can only burn this much coal, oil and gas. And once you've got this limit and this budget set at a sustainable level, the question is how you distribute it. And of course, the only way you can make this happen politically is to have fair shares for everybody. So you then have a per capita distribution amongst all the world's nations, which means that China and India get a lot, the UK and Japan get much less, and they should be tradable in between them, so you have a sort of convergence process. But essentially, when you're talking about rationing, this is what got us in Britain through the Second World War, was knowing that we all had equal access to what was left of our food supplies, and we had a national emergency. This is a global emergency, and we've all got to make the same kinds of sacrifices. And I think the Contraction and Convergence Programme, which is actually it's on the web, gci.org.uk, it's promoted by the Global Commons Institute, is being taken seriously now at the governmental levels in Europe. The African countries have signed up to it pretty much. So has India and China increasingly as well. And even in fact, some of the guys who are on the American delegation, who talk all the time about they can't sign Kyoto because it doesn't include developing countries, you say, okay, well, great. Here's a program which would include developing countries because it includes the whole world, but you've got to agree to equity. You know, and they might say, hey, it's communism, but, you know, it's not communism if you're talking about fairness, which includes all of the world's people, because how can you defend overconsumption in one country and underconsumption in another in perpetuity? You can't. So the only other option is to have economic growth everywhere, and we see the world collapse. So that's why fairness is not just politically correct, it's actually the only way through.
And how do we break through the corporate media's hold on the viewpoints on this? I mean, so much of this, we could be 10 years ahead of where we are now if we'd only heard about this, you know, 10, 12 years ago when people were first talking about it.
Well, I think we have to make it impossible for them not to talk about it on the corporate media. I actually did a spot on Fox News, the O'Reilly Factor, about 2 weeks ago. And I tell you, that was an experience because I knew all about Bill O'Reilly and what his take was likely to be, because I think there was one time when he didn't even shout down some September the 11th victims' families and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I knew where he was coming from, and I was sort of all geared up for this row. It turned out, actually, he wasn't hosting. There was a different guy called John Kashinick or something hosting it. He was a Republican ex-senator. And actually, he was asking reasonable questions. So, and I said that I'd come back from Tuvalu with this message, this appeal to the American people, which is what people had said to me when they were in Tuvalu, that climate change was destroying their country and people had to hear this message. But then he ended up with this bizarre assertion that he was a Christian, that the other guest, who was a woman from a right-wing foundation called the Heritage Foundation, was a Christian, and that I shouldn't be making the environment God. And that was a sign-off. And so you end up in some strange situations when you try to get this kind of message out in the in sort of more conventional media. But you have no choice, because this is what people are watching. Whilst it's good to try and cover all your bases and talk to people where you're preaching to the choir as well, because they're the people who are going to be the basis of political action, at the same time, you do need to try and break out into the mainstream, you know. And my book's published by the corporate media, as I say, so I'm 100% behind trying to do that kind of thing, so long as you can keep your integrity and you're not actually selling out in the process.
Seems like in this country, in a lot of ways, people live in such denial that more often than not, we need disasters to get us motivated.
Or disaster movies, yeah.
Well, no, we use disaster movies for entertainment purposes.
Right.
Real disasters we ignore by going to the movies. So, and it looks like in a lot of ways we've created that disaster that, you know, one way or another, we're going to force ourselves to have to deal with this. Do you think it's actually not too late at this point to get a grip on this?
No, it's not too late now, but the window of opportunity is closing rapidly. I mean, we've probably only got, we've got 10 years, really, to make greenhouse gas emissions peak and then start to go down. And if you look at any of the economic forecasts, they're talking about emissions rising for the next century or more. And so that's the challenge that we've got, really, which is why if Bush gets back into the White House, we're running out of time. So that's why this election is really crucial for the future of the whole of the planet, actually. This is one of the things that I talk about. Time is running out, but it's important to remember that it's not too late and that we can avoid the disasters, because when they come, it will be too late. By the time global warming has got the momentum to really affect people in a way which cripples economies and which puts millions of people off the land and hungry, then we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions probably won't make much difference. Mm. And so we've got to avoid that scenario.
In addition to your book, what other resources can people turn to get more information, get more support on this?
Well, I do think of this as a campaigning tool, in fact. I mean, I've started off as a campaigner, and more of a campaigner than I am a writer, actually, between you and me and our listeners here and viewers. And so in the back of the book, I have a list of websites and so on. It's fairly well known. I mean, there's this Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth who are running campaigns on this, NRDC. There's that kind of thing. But also, I think it's important that people don't just leave it to the environmental groups now. We've really got to be talking to our senators about this. We've got to be talking to local politicians about this. We've got to talk to friends and family about this and make people face up to their own lifestyle choices. And so climate change has got to get personal. You know, it's not the role of some professional campaigners to keep moving this one forward, because it's got to be out there and it's got to be the concerns of millions of people. They just don't realize it yet.
Just been talking with Mark Linus. He is author of the new book, High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis.
And Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio was the interviewer. Fasten your seat belts, because for the remainder of the program, we're going to hear about military experiments in Alaska that may already be contributing to weather disasters. The talk we're about to hear was given by Nick Begich last February at the 3rd Annual Sustainable Living Conference at Evergreen University in Olympia, Washington. Begich is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Sr. Nick Begich Jr. was twice elected president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. Begich received his doctorate in traditional medicine from the Open International University for Complementary Medicines in 1994. He's been pursuing independent research in the sciences and politics for most of his adult life. He's also the editor of Earth Pulse Flashpoints, a new science book series. Begich has served as an expert witness and speaker before the European Parliament. He's spoken on various issues for groups representing citizen concerns, statesmen and elected officials, scientists and others. He's the author of several books about secret military technologies, including Angels Don't Play This Harp, Earth Rising, and Towards a New Alchemy. Nick Begich.
The big issues that I want to touch on today, I want to cover the HARP system, which is a high-frequency active auroral research project operated by the U.S. Navy and Air Force in Alaska, and recently the management of that has been taken by DARPA, which does defense research essentially for the military. The project started in Alaska as an experiment to build a developmental prototype in advance of ground-based Star Wars weapon systems technology that was being contemplated back in the 1980s. The system itself, when it first came up, environmental groups in Alaska really weren't paying too much attention to it. They were looking at the ground disturbance in terms of filling in of wetlands, because the area involved is about 5,000 acres eventually for this full facility. So there was some concern about ground disturbances, but the real issue was what this system was designed to do. And that's what we're going to cover a good deal of this afternoon. When the military first looked at Alaska, there were several things that were driving this project. In terms of missile defense, it was a very controversial issue during the Dole and Clinton elections. In fact, Dole raised this issue at the very end of the campaign, saying, you know, we can do Star Wars, we can do it a lot cheaper, because now we can develop this ground-based technology, so we don't have to have a totally satellite-based system. And one of the early problems with Star Wars during the Reagan administration was this idea of being able to utilize energy-based weapon systems from low-orbiting space platforms and targeting objects on the ground. That was the original kind of concept. One of the problems was stabilizing satellites. And if anyone's done any carpentry work in the room, you know that when you're a 16th of an inch out on one end and you're going across the room, you start swinging an awful big distance. So when you're dealing with satellites, trying to precision drop a laser or something like this, a particle beam weapon, you need a very narrow band, and you need some accuracy because you don't want to miss your target. So that problem was a big hang-up in the 80s. That was resolved just at the very end of the last century, and there's been a number of media reports about stabilizing satellites. So those have come back into the game. There's a couple of weapons concepts that have been introduced or military concepts in recent years that are extremely important to this discussion. One of them is the concept introduced by Bush, which was this idea of preemptive warfare, the idea of deciding who your enemies are before they do anything and just wiping them out, which we just did in Iraq. That concept is a dangerous concept when you lay on top of it the idea of energy-based weapon systems. And the reason is speed. Energy-based weapon systems, lasers, particle beams, you're dealing with weapons that are delivering their power at 186,300 miles per second in terms of speed versus conventional delivery systems. Intercontinental ballistic missiles traveling in reentry might make 30,000 miles an hour at optimum speeds. And you've all heard about this defense system that's being developed in Alaska where they're going to have interceptors shooting down missiles in flight. And it's like the story of the bullet hitting the bullet. If anyone has followed that over the years, there's been some scientists that have walked out of that program saying, it's a setup in terms of what's been designed. These are not real conditions. The likelihood of the system working is pretty remote. Yet, they're spending an awful lot of our money in Alaska today building this system. If you've watched the news in the last week, there were some Russian exercises of new missile systems that actually, on reentry, the whole idea is you've got a straight trajectory that you can predict. Now they have a way to alter in flight those incoming ICBMs, which make the system we're just beginning to build in Alaska already obsolete. The real system will most likely be an energy-based weapon system. When you see the movement of China in space, it's not about going to the moon. It's about maintaining some balance in space. And war is moving from the ground to these low-orbiting space platforms. Now, one of the problems with those is energy, and this is where HAARP starts to come into the picture, and we'll talk a lot about that as we go on. The idea of energizing these platforms, providing energy to them in low orbits where the orbits degrade rather rapidly. You want to be able to keep them up, so you got to have a fuel source. And one of the original concepts was maybe we can tap some energy out of the ionosphere, this layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface, extends for a couple hundred miles out, that we could tap this layer, pull energy out of this layer, and use this in these weapon systems, in these weapon system developments. One of the other ideas that started back in the 60s was the idea of maybe we can take energy, convert it to some other form, wirelessly send it to these orbiting space platforms and cause them to be energized. But the technology for receiving and sending that kind of focused energy really wasn't there in the 60s. The same scientists involved in that work are now at the University of Alaska Fairbanks doing work using the systems that have been developed at HAARP. And what HAARP is essentially a phased array, an antenna field. If you were to look at it today, you'll see 48 antenna masts, 72 feet high, and then across a dipole. So it looks like a big field of antennas. And what happens with those, they produce radio frequency energy. And what they do is they concentrate that energy. If you think about radio frequency energy, and anyone that's studied physics knows the basic rule is as you come off of those antennas, off of those sources, the energy spreads out very rapidly, becomes increasingly less and less dense or concentrated. So eventually, as you get away from these radio transmitters, your energy decreases, the sound signal decreases, and eventually you don't hear the station anymore. In this case, by firing the antennas in a very specific way, they create what's called a cyclotron resonance, where that energy is actually focused or concentrated by analogy in a similar way to a laser concentrating light, because it follows that same rule. As the energy comes off of a flashlight and you shine it on the wall, you get this huge beam that gets wider and wider with distance, whereas a laser keeps it compact and tight. By analogy, the same idea was applied to the development of the HAARP technology. Now, the person that originated the patents was a guy named Dr. Bernard Eastland, who did a lot of work for the military. He did a lot of work in the nuclear programs back in the 50s and 60s. We've kept a pretty good dialogue with Ben Eastland. In fact, I had dinner with him in San Diego a couple weeks ago. talking about sort of where this technology has gone and where it's going. The thing that happened with Eastland is he was working independently as a researcher, and he came up with this concept that if we could figure out how to focus this energy into the ionosphere, specifically into the magnetic field lines, that maybe we could utilize the Earth's natural magnetic field lines as part of this weapons technology. And so what Eastland developed was this concept, and he actually achieved a number of patents on the concept. They're cited in our book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, and they're also on my website. And there's a lot of articles on this that you're welcome to pull down from the website. It's earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com. In that, what Bernard basically did is he approached Atlantic Richfield, which was one of the largest oil and gas producers in Alaska at the time, with huge reserves at that point, in proven reserves, over 4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas and no market for that gas. In fact, many of you are aware of this whole debate about gas pipeline coming out of Alaska to bring natural gas to Lower 48. In all the years that we've had the North Slope oil fields, that gas has been reinjected back into the field, keeping the field pressurized until markets could be found for that gas. Well, ARCO, looking at it, says, you know, what can we do with the gas right where we're at? And what Bernard had developed, Dr. Eastland had developed, was this idea that if we could pump energy in to these magnetic field lines in a very specific way, that they would act as wave guides. And so when you think about this, most of you are familiar with those illustrations of those magnetic field lines coming out of the South Pole, wrapping around, getting their furthest distance at the equator, and then wrapping back into the northern regions of the world. And this is depicted in a lot of illustrations in terms of what happens with energy in the planet. What they've done is map these magnetic field lines, and they found that the natural flow from south to north, if you pump energy in using this type of transmitter, the energy will, like, if you could visualize, would be like a corkscrewing motion forming around those magnetic field lines moving from north to south. And the idea was that by using those, the natural components of the Earth as part of this machine on the ground, that any object passing through this energy field would be disrupted electronically. So this was the idea of creating a global shield for intercontinental ballistic missiles, which was the original concept of Dr. Eastland when he first fielded this issue. One of the principal people that he took this to was a guy named Ramos, who was one of the founders of TRW and one of the initiators of Star Wars during the Reagan administration. And this was one of those missing links. When he saw the first view graphs and illustrations, Bernard said it best. He said that he immediately recognized the potency of it, expanded the ideas, and they jointly filed an additional patent. That then began to drive the research. And the first research done was done by a subsidiary that Bernard formed, which was called ARCO Power Technologies, Inc., $30 million a year company, small subsidiary, 25 employees at the time, mostly lobbyists in Washington, D.C. looking for money from military planners. And the first thing they did is test this idea of sending energy wirelessly into a low-orbiting space platform. It was written up in Aviation Weekly. The dates of the site are in articles on the web as well as the book. But this idea of sending energy up was the first thing that caught the military's attention, because they were able to demonstrate the practicality of it with a small-scale system in Canada. The next thing that came up was the idea that this had a lot of versatility as an instrument, potentially, because if you are able to manipulate the conditions of the ionosphere, which is responsible for lots of the stability of communications, when it's disturbed, communications are disturbed globally. So understanding the ionosphere has been a long area of research for military. Controlling the ionosphere is the issue of HAARP. How to control the conditions there to either interfere with communications of an adversary or be able to maintain, while you're doing that interference, your own communication system. So that was another sort of attribute of HAARP, was this idea of being something that could be used to disrupt communications within a battle environment while at the same time maintaining your own, which for most people that study these things, this is a major issue for militaries. The next thing that came up that was kind of interesting was a concept called earth-penetrating tomography. Simple analogy, looking into the Earth, or by analogy would be like X-raying the Earth, only in this case using radio frequency energy. And essentially what happens is this is a high-frequency transmitter, first of all. So it's got a very narrow band of primary operation in terms of how it works. But the way they can pulse it and modulate that signal, they can create basically effects within what's called 16 decades of frequency. From ultra-low frequency to visible light, they can affect this whole band in different ways by manipulating the instrument on the ground. Well, one of the things they found early on in research, even prior to HARP, was research being done in Europe, was the idea that if you pump energy into the ionosphere in an extremely low frequency range, an ELF range, which is between, in the case of HARP, between about between 1 and 100 hertz is the operating range for creating this earth-penetrating tomography application particularly. What they found is that the ionosphere changes from being a direct current to an oscillating current, changes its character. So it begins to pulse with the pulse rate of the signal coming off the ground in harmony with it. And they actually tried this in Europe with a system called IZICAT, and they actually caused the ionosphere to pulse to the sound of Wagner, as an example. A big change, you know, in terms of what they were doing. They thought it was kind of neat, but what you end up with is a lot of specialists looking at only one aspect of what they're doing, not considering where other areas. You know, the thing about this college that I like is the multidisciplinary approach that people take to the sciences, which is really the right approach. In military research, it's compartmentalized, segregated, and separated, so one discipline never knows what the other is doing in most cases, and a lot is lost between the physicists and the living scientists, the biologists, electrophysiologists, people who are interested in life sciences versus just the physics of these things. And I think that separation has really caused a lot of problems in terms of industrial development in the United States. If you compare it to what was going on in the Soviet Union, they used the opposite approach, multidisciplinary teams. They got a lot more bang for the buck, a lot more lateral thinking, a lot more produced in terms of intellectual outcomes for a lot less money. It was the way they kept up, quite frankly, was multidisciplinary teams. It's also the way they developed their standards for instance, electromagnetic exposures of various kinds. In some instances, are 1,000 times more stringent than U.S. standards. That's a pretty significant thing when you start to think about what's safe and what isn't and who's making those decisions in the United States. With HARP, the idea of earth-penetrating tomography became pretty interesting. And in fact, in 1996, under the military's defense budget, it was funded that year under non-proliferation and counter-proliferation, is where HARP appears in the budget. Because the Senate said at that time, it was right after Gulf War I, I guess we can call it, and they were real interested in finding underground facilities. And this issue became a primary issue. If we had a technology that could go in and get a scan a couple kilometers deep to see what underground facilities, shelters, mineral stratas existed there, that we might be able to locate these facilities. So it was funded as a priority, and they wouldn't get any more funding until they proved that. And there was a guy named Papadopoulos from the University of Maryland who was involved in this research. He was interviewed on BBC TV on a show called Horizons. And what he said is that when they ran this test, that they had statistically a 99.9% accuracy, which is about as good as it gets, in locating the exact perimeters of an underground mining facility, tunnels and the like, where they knew, you know, they knew by surveys exactly where everything was, and they were able to compare the data that they developed using using the HARP system essentially to create this effect. What they're able to do is get pretty clear imaging. In fact, it came up again right after 9/11. MSNBC in November of 2001, I think it was November 27th, actually ran a story, and it was a story about utilizing HARP for earth-penetrating tomography, for this idea of looking into the earth in Afghanistan, and then, of course, it came up again in Iraq. The thing is, it's just one system for ground imaging. If you watch the wars in these last two situations, most of the war was fought at night. It's as visible to us as the day when you really start looking at the type of sensors that are available to militaries today. And not just the terror effect of bombing people in the middle of the night, but the idea that you can get good, clear imaging. Underground, you can even differentiate a half a degree temperature differential, so you can start to sort out the human bodies from hardware, not using a HARP system, but using other kinds of sensors that are available to militaries today. So you get a lot of things, seismic sensors, ground-penetrating tomography, heat sensors, a lot of different imaging-type sensors that give you some depth of penetration. The other thing that comes up when you start talking about extremely low-frequency signals is this idea that maybe there might be other effects. And one of the things that comes up is the effect on human health. And ELFs, extremely low-frequency signals, got a lot of controversy back in the 70s. Many may remember this controversy of these transmitters used for communication with submarines. They were using a very low frequency, very long wavelengths, and so they buried 14 to 26 mile antennas in Michigan and Wisconsin, this area of the country. And it created a lot of controversy. People were saying there's health effects, there's problems with this. You know, these kinds of transmitters have been buried basically because you need these long wavelengths to penetrate the earth and sea for communication with submarines, as an example. Short wavelengths do not penetrate deep enough. The problem comes in with what other effects occur with ELF. And one of the things that shows up, and this is where the physicists lose sight of the life science, there's been a tremendous amount of work in external fields, non-ionizing radiation, low levels of energy, having tremendous effects physiologically. And in the past, go back 20 years, there's a lot of controversy about this. There's still a lot of controversy because a few of the guys from the old school are still around that are still fighting this battle, saying low levels of energy are pretty much transparent to the body. What has been discovered is that there are very specific window frequencies that can have tremendous impact on the human body. There was a study done, for instance, University of Utah in 1985, and it produced for the Air Force a book called the Radio Frequency Dosimetry Handbook. And you can get it as a public document. And it basically gives you the radio frequency dosages for affecting liver, kidneys, lungs, heart, basically to override the natural operation of those organs and cause them to malfunction, degrading the ability of people to engage in combat, as an example. This is part of that sort of initiative for non-lethal kind of weapons, looking at other instabilities that can be created in the body or in hardware that doesn't require bombs, bullets, and the normal ripping of tissue that all of us have seen in warfare. It's changing to a warfare that's CNN compatible. It doesn't create the same kind of visual images. And that is a big issue for military planners. The images that come back from the battlefield change the public opinion about what we're doing in many instances. But if you can create situations where the apparent of destruction is not so obvious, people tend to take a little different view of it. The other thing that's happened that's changed military is we are removing ourselves further and further from the battlefield in terms of what kind of damage we can inflict, almost like running video games today. A lot of things are done at a distance. Changes the dimension of warfare, because when you're doing it from a distance, the same emotional effects are not there. You're engaged in a battle, but it's sort of removed. You come back from that battle, yeah, you have feelings about all that, but you're not looking in the whites of the eyes of the people that you're killing, so you come back with a much different attitude. It becomes easier and easier to fight wars when you don't have to see your enemy. And I think this is one of the additional problems beyond preemptive warfare, is this idea of distancing ourselves from the human dimension of warfare, which is the dimension that caused our fathers, grandfathers, and great-grandfathers to return from war and say, I don't want my kids and the next generation going there. And they do everything they can to avoid it, and that's changing. Preemptive warfare is the wrong direction of that change. The thing that came up with HAARP that was pretty interesting from my perspective is the lack of coverage. And part of it was the environmental community's recognition of energy, not in the form of oil and gas, but energy being utilized to manipulate environmental or human factors. When you talk about the human body, do you remember a few years ago, this was probably now 5 or 6 years ago, there was a story in Japan about a bunch of children watching a cartoon on television, and the flicker rate of the light caused 700 of them to go to hospitals with epileptic seizures. Now, so I see some nods, so I know some people have remembered that story. Now, everyone will tell you in the scientific community, almost everyone will tell you, it's, you know, light emitted from a television set is harmless, you know. The fact of the matter is, generally speaking, that's true, but if you can maintain a specific pulse rate at a specific rhythm within one of these window frequencies, you can cause huge changes biologically within the body. This is the base of research for the development of a whole new array of weapons that fall into this general category that the military now refers to this whole movement as a revolution of military affairs. Today they're actually referring to it now as a revolution of military and political affairs, and they equate it to the introduction of gunpowder in the Middle Ages in terms of its effect in Europe and warfare and the way it changed, or atomic weapons in the last century. That's what's happening now. And when you hear Rumsfeld and others start to talk about these new systems, these energy-based systems, that's what he's talking about, is energy systems that discharge at tremendous velocity with incredible power. And this is being developed by not just our military. If you look at the Public reports have been released from the intelligence committees of our U.S. Senate. You see sweeping reports on China's efforts in this area. And you hear our mainstream media discount those efforts, saying, well, Chinese spend only $40 billion a year on military. We're spending $400 billion a year. It's not a problem. You get a lot more for your buck in China. $40 billion in China, probably in output, produces twice what we produce in real output, hardware on the other end of the production line. It's not to be underestimated. In fact, when you look at genius as it spreads across populations, the likelihood of China developing the level of genius necessary, and then through a centralized system, pulling that genius into military programs, is got a lot higher probability than in the West. At the same time, ideologically, what has happened? We all talk about, oh, this is wonderful, we have all this trade. That trade is predicated on a difference in philosophy at the root. Chinese knew they could not get their production kicked in gear. You know, you convert a factory today from producing electronic boards to computers to producing electronic boards for missiles by just loading in new software. It's not like it was in World War II, where you spent 6 or 8 months or even a year sometimes reconverting a plant. You can do it very quickly and very efficiently today. What happened in Soviet Russia, we didn't supply them the weapons, but our financial institutions, people like Arm & Hammer and others, went over and we built their industrial capacity. We made sure they had factories, and we made sure they had the ability to produce iron and steel, but we didn't tell them how to build the bomb, but we gave them the infrastructure to do it. We're doing the same thing in China today, based on trade and how we relate to trade. At the same time, they take, and according to Senate intelligence reports, this sort of long view of the world, and there's a lot of patience. We look at things in the U.S. quarter to quarter, you know, for whatever reasons are driving that sort of short-sightedness. This long view takes a much different position, and it results in a much different direction. When you start adding in these other factors and these changes in the way we look at war, all of this becomes extremely relevant. The idea, consider the idea of modifying the ionosphere, a natural component that essentially screens out lots of energy that would otherwise make life impossible on the planet. It's a very important thing. When you think of ozone depletion, that's a problem. When you think about interference with ionospheric activity, that may or may not become even a bigger problem, depending on what happens. So the military says, it's a big system, you know, there's a lot of energy there. We're just, you know, we're a grain of sand on the beach. The difference is we're using coherent, rhythmic energy that's designed to do specific things. If you look at early work done at Stanford University on the ionosphere, and if you look at the ionosphere above it, the magnetosphere, where those two couple, where they come together, and many of you remember this from the books. You just see the Earth, and you see this ionosphere, and then you see the magnetosphere, and then you see the magnetotail, which kind of whips back behind, and it's sort of the energy blow-off as it comes around the planet. The interactions, the interference with that is what this is all about. And what they found at Stanford is that if they pumped energy in a very specific frequency in the VLF range, it actually, when it hit this upper area of the ionosphere, the signal amplified 1,000 times. Now that's significant stuff, because you're talking about taking an analogy would be like the primer on a bullet. You know, it's a little bit of energy release that releases the larger amount of energy in the gunpowder. The same is true here. Utilizing instruments on the ground and finding those areas of instability that can be triggered artificially, you then create a way to tap that energy in a way that becomes weapons applicable. And that's what HAARP is all about. When DARPA took it over, they have 2 years. They took it over this last year. They have 2 years in which they're going to take that 48 antenna array and move it to 180 and increase the power by 400%. Now, that's still only half of where they want to go. Eventually, what they want out of this system, according to their own documents, is 1 billion watts of effective radiated power. Now, that's not the input power. That's the effective radiated power. That includes these capitalizations of these instabilities as well. But 1 billion watts, think about that. I mean, think about the average household light bulb at 60. Just to put it in perspective, the biggest radio stations in the country, I think, today are around 50,000 watts. I think there's still a couple of those around. There might even be one or two larger ones. But you're talking 1 billion watts.
You're listening to Nick Begich on Unwelcome Guests. And you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. We continue.
Now, what they found, going back to this story in Japan, where the light flicker caused this effect with all these kids having epileptic seizures, what was that about? They maintained a coherent signal, a flicker rate that was within that window frequency for a long enough period of time to trigger chemical reactions within the brain. You know, and the work in this area goes, you know, goes a lot further. When you start to look at what has been discovered is that external oscillating fields within specific frequencies can create the same thing, whether it's flickering light, or they can create the same effect using what's called binaural beat. It was invented in the 1960s. Sound, we can't hear these really low frequency sounds. We can't hear down that low. Our ears aren't set up for that. So what they did is they developed a technique where they send in a sound signal, say at 17,000 hertz or cycles per second or pulses per second in one ear, and they send in one, say at 17,007. They cross, they cancel, and they leave a beat frequency of 7, the difference between 17,000 and 17,007.